Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. For over 45 years, we've helped over 500,000 homeowners make their homes drier, healthier, and more valuable. Our warranties are transferable and estimates are free. Call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
And welcome back to Paul Listed Behind the Curtain, going on now at Looking Glass Theater, and it's called Iraq But Funny. A very interesting title we're going to learn more about. And you know, if I could have the star of the show, the playwright of the show, that would be fabulous. I get both of them, and I get it in one person. How unusual is that? Joining me is Atra Azdu, who is indeed the playwright, but also a star. Looking Glass is ensemble. A star of Iraq But Funny at Looking Glass. Atra, thank you for being with me. The show was amazing. Saw it at an opening night. You got to give me the history of the show. Obviously, I mean, I should say it's about five relationships through time. It starts at the Ottoman Empire and goes through today. But the importance of these relationships between mothers and daughters all the way go through. And yet it's set in politics. Clear it up. It's about politics, relationships, and it's also very funny.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on here, Paul. And thank you so much for coming to opening night as well. It's about five generations of Assyrian women trying to reclaim their story from the Ottoman Empire to modern day USA. And it's all narrated by a British guy. So they kind of go back and forth over trying to reclaim their story and reclaim their narrative in the midst of having to, continue life on throughout all the political and geopolitical happenings in that period of time. So it's about how historical and world events, including politics, but historical and world events affect family dynamics as well, and how that trauma continues on every generation and how every generation tries and reclaims a little bit more every time. So
what's intriguing, though, is you have the story told by the British guy, right? And the English gentleman, I should say, because we can give him the shorthand of Teg, which you do. But that being said, since you created it, I mean, there could be a story about Assyrians, and it is. What led you to decide that it would be about Assyrian women reclaiming their identity and their relationship, but we're going to let the British guy give the narrative?
Well, the historical parts, the British were involved a lot in the modern last 100 years of Iraq's history. And so that part to me, and the reasons why these families had to keep fleeing, like in my family, they had to keep fleeing. They never really got to settle into a place for many generations. It was like each generation had to flee, sometimes multiple times within a generation. So that when I started writing the play about 4 and some years ago now, the idea was these separate timelines where it's just the historical parts and then just the family. And we kind of have vignettes. And then as it became developed, they kind of weaved together, got woven together in how each one interplays with the other. And it turned into how who gets to tell the story and how the story gets taken back.
So you performed, look, drama, comedy, you've been on the Goodman stage and the Steppenwolf stage and Yale Repertory. I mean, you've really been everywhere, but this, I think, is the first kind of all-in-one encompassing venture. But you're also part of the Looking Glass Theater Ensemble. So at Looking Glass, you don't bring them a play and go, here it is, buy it or not. I mean, it becomes this interactive process to create what we are seeing on stage.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And the ensemble is there's workshops. So how it starts is every year they send out new play development questionnaires. Do you have an idea? Anything from a little seedling to like the Dostoevsky or the, a play based off of all of Michelangelo's works that you've been working on for the last 40 years, however many. There's a wide span of generating ideas that come in from all these brilliant minds, and we pitch. And a few get chosen to get workshops. And then from there, that could just like, I just need a workshop. That's it. I don't need anything else. And sometimes they want to develop it outside the theater. And sometimes the theater, the ensemble starts to see traction on one and wants to keep developing it. So, or not just on one, but quite a few. And so as a theater that produces primarily our own work that operates between ensemble, board, and staff, we get to pitch our plays and develop them. So I pitched Iraq But Funny as like a seedling of an idea for a place to put my family stories and also to talk about the historical timelines of Iraq and make it a comedy, because that's not what people usually associate with Iraq. And to
Right,
change the
right.
narrative that way.
It
Thank
is
you.
so funny
Thank
and
you.
clearly very personal humor. We're clearly getting your family story weaved in parts of this, I'm sure. When does the director in this case, Dalia Asharina, when did she get involved? Like, does she come with the package, or do we agree to do the show and now let's find a director and we have to cast it?
It was a bit of both. I had only met Dahlia because I was doing a play called Leyalina at the Goodman in 2023, and the playwright M. Yusuf Zabai had known Dahlia, and then I hadn't. But he was like, "Do you know Dahlia? She's in New York as well. She was the resident director on Phantom of the Opera in Broadway, and also did Sweeney Todd." And so he was like, "You two should connect." So he matchmaked, and then when I went back to New York, we got a coffee and like talked for like 4 hours. And then she showed me something that she was working on. I showed her the Iraq But Funny that I was working on. And then I had her in mind as we were continuing to do workshops. And so we invited her out to direct one of the workshops. And then from there, it was like, this is a great, I can't imagine literally anybody else doing this.
The
So.
show works so well. How critical is the humor? I think without the humor, this becomes a play about politics and whatever. The humor just brings it to a whole new level.
I think, I mean, I process the world through humor, and I process hard things through humor, and so I'm always a fan of making people laugh. And I think when we laugh, we're in a really, really present in a room together, especially when one catches you by surprise or you feel like I shouldn't have laughed at that. Like, but you're in a room of people who are going, "Oh God, I can't believe we're laughing at this." It's healing, and so it's critical. It's so critical. I don't think I would have been interested in writing a play about Iraq that wasn't funny. And it's something that I know growing up that they are very funny people.
And you have a cast of six, sorry, five others who are playing, and they all play the roles through the generations. They're
Yeah,
magnificent. They're
they
truly
are.
wonderful. Was it like, love that one, love that? Or, I mean, the one who plays the bombs all the way through, whatever, it's just masterful casting. Or did you have your own mom in mind and went, that's kind of like her?
I mean, I couldn't just have my mom in mind because there's five
Yeah,
generations,
right.
and every character is kind of an amalgamation of people I know versus it being like a one-to-one. But the casting process was so magical, and Dahlia and I, sent out the casting call. Kareem Bendiali helped us with the casting as well, and a Looking Glass ensemble member and mentor to this play from its beginnings. And so, just doing that, and also Casey Foster, artistic director, helped with casting as well. And so just sending out the casting call for a play that involved Assyrians and folks from the Swana region that was a comedy, I got to meet new people. I got to see different people's talents and acting styles. And so it was such a gift to be able to do that. And it like sparked within me, like, oh, okay, maybe not this one, but the next one. I got an idea to do something for that person. Now that I know that person's skill set, I want to like write something to that person. So it was just a magical, magical thing. And it really came together in a beautiful way. It's a hard play to do. And so with the primary cast and with our extended cast too, our covers, we're just so blessed.
And you, I mean, the character who plays a lot of the dads, he was in Band's Visit on Broadway. I
Yeah,
mean,
James Rana, yeah.
the talent is just incredible. After I'm not done with you, can you stay? Unfortunately, the show has to close, but can you stay with me and just have a little more conversation for people who have or want to see Iraq But Funny? There's more we have to talk about. Can you hang with me?
Absolutely happy to.
I appreciate that. Be sure to see Iraq But Funny at Looking Glass Theater through July 20th. July 20th, lookingglasstheater.org, spelled the proper way, TRE British. Lookingglasstheater.org. It's a world premiere. Actor Azdu, congratulations. A magnificent show. And thanks for joining us here on Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain. And we are back here on Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain, continuing my conversation about the incredible world premiere of Iraq But Funny, which is playing at Looking Glass Theater. And I'm joined by the playwright and the performer, this one of the stars, Attra Azdu. You are the star, but it's an ensemble theater, so we have to word it this way. So I have to ask you this question. Looking Glass, nothing you don't know, is very well known for its gymnastics, its acrobatics, its Cirque du Soleil. This is not that. This show is not that. However, I won't say what it is, but there is an opening to the show where I thought, aha, there's Looking Glass. Was that always part of the show, or is that a bit of homage?
That was You know, we went through different iterations up until like the last few days of tech of how to open the show, and our dream was an even bigger spectacle, but we thought of it a little too late in the game, and so we couldn't like get the proper people with the proper training to help train us on it. I won't give it away because maybe it'll happen in future iterations,
Oh,
but.
okay.
But yeah, that part, it does feel very, when I do it, I feel very Looking Glass and of like, okay, cool. This is a part
But
of
I guess what I'm
it.
asking is, so because you're saying we might do it, whatever, is it because we're looking, would you be doing it if you were at Steppenwolf? I mean, it's like, no, it's about being in the Looking Glass home.
I think it would have to depend on the space, but that we're in Looking Glass definitely had a horde of people behind us going like, what about this? What about that? And it being more spectacly. So that, I think that is, in homage to, and also from the developmental depths of that theater,
I knew when I saw Larry Dastasi in the opening night audience, who, of course, part of the creation of the Actors Gymnasium, I knew something was up.
Sylvia, yeah.
Yeah, right. It's right. How do you, as a playwright and one of the lead actors, how do you work with a director? I mean, she's got a job to do. Dolly has a job to do. Are you in her way?
I wasn't. No, we were very collaborative. We were very, very collaborative. And Dahlia, as a person, is just a very open-hearted and collaborative person. She has a vision. She has ideas. She comes in with really strong and brilliant moves. And she's still open to play. Like her whole thing is like, let me just figure. Let's put a broad stroke on, and then let's figure it out from there. And she's open to pitches and open to ideas. She's an actor's director. She's a designer's director. She's a full production, well-rounded, brilliant mind. So,
No, she
yeah.
let you play. Since she's an actor's director, does that mean the whole cast gets to participate in that process?
There was collaboration even with the actors. I mean, they're wonderful actors. They make choices on their own, and we, you know, and even in the playwriting actor relationship. I am a very collaborative person. I'd go, do you like saying that line? How does that feel natural to you? And sometimes they would pitch me on bits too of like, oh, I had an idea of like, I want to come in and do this. And I'm like, let's try it. So we were very much a let's try it and see kind of room. And also such an egoless room that if something didn't work or wasn't in service to the story, no one was, you know, downhearted for too long. So,
And
yeah.
I know you live in New York, but Chicago is a home for you, right? You lived here, you trained at Second City and IO and all that. There are so many clever aspects to the show. Never like to give things away, but let's just say lots of homage to films, Rocky in a big way. What came first was, I have this story I have to tell. What's a clever way to do it? Or did your funny mind come up with this Rocky thing and go, I think I know what to do with that?
So a little bit of both. I think as I wrote it, I was writing very, especially the English gentleman character, Teg. He's very cerebral, very academic. And so my first few passes at him were his monologues where he would do jump into voices and jump in and out of things and do act outs, as the stand-ups say. And then as we developed it in workshops, Dahlia, being the brilliant director that she is, asked wonderful questions, and she would say, well, what are his sandboxes? Like, a few things had genres that I had played with, but not every one of his moments had genres. And so she spotted that pattern and was like, what else can we make this? And so between the boxing thing actually came around because our dramaturg, new play dramaturg, and also the historical dramaturg on the show, Nisan Mokjiani, he, Dahlia, and I met up, and we were just chatting through all of Teg's arcs and what a specific monologue could have been turned into, and thought about all the different sandboxes, so to say, that he could play and present them in, the different genres he could play and present them in, parodies. And it went through a few iterations before it landed on the boxing one. But yeah, that
Ah.
came out of collaboration and teamwork. Yeah.
Just because I'm interested, can you think of one iteration that you didn't select?
Let me think. There was like a professor bit. There was also what was that before? Like I said, act outs. Oh my gosh, this thing's been 4 years in the making, and sometimes I
Ah,
have to.
yeah.
We were
But it
actually
wasn't
talking
like a
about.
Wizard of Oz scene. I mean, there was nothing that you would say.
Oh, we did have a Wizard of Oz scene. We did have a Wizard of Oz scene, and it got cut because it was like just too much. That was a fine balance too of like what is overpowering the message and what is helping. And so we did have a Wizard of Oz scene.
There is a scene with, I'm going to say, a pot, and if Toto was in there, this would have been really problematic.
No. I'm not eating. No. Toto would not have been there. My first play ever was Wizard of Oz, actually, and Toto, I had a live dog.
That would have been personal homage.
Yeah.
And I know, as you said, part of this is sort of telling a family story. There are a lot of movie references and all that. Are we seeing your family in a lot of those references?
Yeah. I mean, the character who references movies is based on my dad. He loves movies. He's loved pop culture. The reason why I have all these references is because of him. We didn't really have a curfew or, I watched everything from Lamb Chop's Play Along to The Godfather by the time I was five. And he would just like hit previous channel if it got to be an intimacy scene, a violent scene, or had too much cussing. And then he would return back to the story, and he made sure that we saw. He lived and digested the world. He's still alive, but he lives and digests the world through art and through film, TV, and books, stories. So it was a way to connect with him, and I got the benefit of it by having all these weird references and deep cuts.
No, I was going to say, if dad was different, or if you just, as it was just more serious parent, whatever, would this show be what it is? Or would you say, I don't know, maybe that stuff wouldn't have occurred to me?
Yeah, I think if both my parents were different, I probably wouldn't have done as much of the show the way it is. I think I would have been a different person. Yeah, I probably would have been a lawyer or
Don't go there. I am one of those. Don't go there.
a doctor. You know.
There are plenty of them. There's lots of fun things that happen in the show. I got to ask you about one, which is there's one point where you are using an overhead projector. Now, I loved overhead projectors when I was back in school, but I thought to myself, you could be doing a PowerPoint. I mean, these days, I mean, we don't use overhead projectors, I don't think, anymore in school and stuff, but that clearly a conscious choice. Can you just talk a little, because by the way, it gives you something to have so much fun with that you couldn't have done it. It had been a PowerPoint or some other way. Was that part of the thing? Like, here's why we want to do it because I get to do lots of shtick? Or did that come because you had the overhead projector sitting in the back of a storage room at the Looking Glass?
So that came about because our projectionist, Michael Commendatore, and our director, Dalia Asharina, that originally was like one of the professor parts where I was just pointing to the projections that are on the back wall. And we got a lot of information already through actual projections on the back wall, and they wanted to find a way to pull it out of the back wall and make it more dynamic. And so they pitched me on an overhead projector. And when I got pitched on it, I was like, oh, I'm going to have all these transparencies, and there's so much information. And if I lose a slide, it's going to go haywire and cut the comedic bit. Like, it's just too many points of failure. And so, but we tried it. We brought it out and we tried it, and it was so much fun to play with. And comedy was discovered in it too. And I can't do it without our crew deckhead, Olivia. And she makes sure that all of my things stay in order and takes care of me. And so it really is a team effort, and it blossomed into some finding comedic bits in
Yeah, I
there.
have to say, I there very rarely, maybe Looking Glass does this sometimes, very rarely do you go to a production where, for lack of better words, the stagehands, whatever you want to call it, but where they get a curtain call. They're
Oh,
critical
they
in this
deserved every
show.
second. Yeah,
Critical
yeah.
in this show.
Yeah, they're running backstage. They are nonstop backstage because this play spans 100 years, and there has to be different costumes to tell the story. We can't exactly shift the set around, the beautiful set that Omid Akbari had made. It's transformative to a certain amount. The lights help us, but really the props, the costumes drive us into different eras. And so yeah, they are nonstop. So they deserve all the applause.
By the way,
Absolutely.
the visuals are nonstop all the way through. They're amazing. Is the dramaturg who steps in to go, I got you covered. I will make all these because I would lose my mind having to do that.
Our projectionist Mike did. Yeah, he did. He did. He took it with such care and heart and comedy and brilliance too. And so he worked on stuff. As I was writing the play, I had tagged some images or references too. So again, it was collaborative. And then if we saw something that we were like, oh, maybe this image or that image instead. So it was a collaboration between Dahlia, Michael, myself, and also our dramaturg Nason.
And you got to give credit because the timing, I mean, you say things, it's like a click, it's like a move. That stuff, the timing has to be perfect and where these things show up and whatever. And it was when I went there on opening night. Who gets credit for that?
That's our stage management team and also sound design as well. Christy Childs Twilley has a brilliant ear, and the way lights, projections, and sound have to match up, she would help us with some sound underneath some things to help punctuate the comedy or help deepen the heartful and soulful parts of the play to make things a spectacle. So the soundscape and that all of those cues are being called by our stage manager, Izzy Pat. They're amazing. Again, they are nonstop up in the booth.
Yeah. So again, not only you're a playwright and a dramatic performer and a comedic performer, but you also have improv in your background. And I mentioned that your character, Tag, the English gentleman, you do improv with this audience. So number one, does anybody who should ever play Tag in the future have to have that skill, or did that get built in because it was going to be you?
I mean, I wrote it from what I know. You write what you know. So, I think as we were casting originally, I wasn't planning on playing him. But if I were to cast him not as myself, it would have to be somebody who is has experience with audience interaction. They don't necessarily have to have graduated from the Second City or IO, but if they are an actor with experience or a fearlessness about them in playing with the audience one-on-one, then that's a must.
You make it look really easy and stuff. And having done corporate speaking, where I understand the world of playing with audience members, that is a skill. Being able to read somebody and not picking somebody who does not want to be a part of anything for whatever reason they have, maybe they're having a bad day. That is a skill, right? Have you ever gotten it wrong?
I hope I haven't gotten it wrong, but I definitely have, when I call on someone and I like read them, and there was one woman who was not looking at me and she had her hands in her hoodie pocket and she elbowed the guy sitting next to her, and I went, "I see you elbowing." So I just acknowledged it, and then I went, "If the audience member does not want to participate, I don't want to torture them. I'm not here to torture anybody in this experience. I want us all to have fun." So I had fun with the person sitting next to her who participated. I will say by intermission, she was speaking up and like throwing some things over my way. And I was like, "Oh, that made me feel so joyful." 'Cause I was like, "Okay, you opened up and you're here and you feel comfortable." And I feel so proud to be in a room where people feel comfortable to do that.
And it may have just been that you took her off guard, and so she wasn't ready for it.
I
Like I,
mean,
during when I was there, you played with my partner myself a little bit, and even I was like, "Am I supposed to do something? I just didn't get because I'm an idiot. I didn't get it."
No. It's a lot of pressure. You already paid for the ticket and you're taking in the show, and now you got to do the work too. I'm
Oh,
sorry.
trust me, had I realized that I would have gone up on stage and say, "I'm happy, let's do a bit." I didn't. Fortunately for you, I didn't think of that.
You're welcome anytime.
Yeah, but so therefore, how important is it? Like the night I was there, which was opening, and the crowd laughing in there. I mean, it's so great. And I know you have that every night, so this is just a hypothetical. But how difficult would it become if an audience, for whatever reason, isn't on board with the show? You need them for this show.
We do, yeah. I think we've had, quieter houses, and it's always fascinating to me as a performer and as a writer, as a comedian, to be like, oh, okay, specific times of day or specific nights, people are just in the rhythm of the day is different. And they're never not with us though. I see people leaning in. I see people when I ask a question of the audience, and they're just not very vocal. And so you have very vocal houses, and you have very just hard listeners. And by the end, I really love a house that's been quiet, but then a joke lands and the entire house pops, and it's like, oh, we're like an hour 45 in, and we got you. And you're still with us, and like we got you with a joke, and it like bubbled out of you, and I love that. Like, okay, all right, so we're all still in the room together. I don't know if any of that made sense, but I feel really
It
proud of.
does. You know where it took me? Because again, you do improv. So what took me is it's an improv challenge for you. So even though this is a scripted play with some improv in the audience piece, but this has to be for you. It's sort of like for these moments, I'm doing improv, and if I have a tough audience in an improv club, that's what I got to deal with.
And that's what the very basis of improv, as you know, is yes and. So if people aren't feeling it, you got to yes and that. Yes, you aren't feeling it, and I'm still going to give you a show, and we're still going to have this very specific, unique experience that no other audience is ever going to have. You're not ever going to have again. And so, yeah, it's just acknowledging it for what it is and embracing it.
I'm curious, just as the cast was getting ready for this, and you're rehearsing and you're having to talk about relationships and all that, What's it like as you're sort of saying, okay, now your relationship from 90 years ago, and now your relationship just moved up a generation. Is that an easy thing for actors to go, got it? Or is it a matter of, this is not, wait a minute, I really have to make some adjustments in my head here?
That's a fantastic question. I do wish we had the rest of the cast to speak on it too, because they do it so brilliantly. I think they all play from such a depth and such heart and such humor and such curiosity that they themselves crafted. I mean, the challenge of having to play over five different roles throughout 100 years, throughout five generations, and what each generation has just experienced, what the generation before them also experienced, and how they carry that as the newer, younger generation and the following elder generation, and making the differentiations between each character. And they do it so beautifully that they were so curious in the room. We had our dramaturg Nason helping us out with any like information what somebody might be going through. If they had any questions, they were also collaborative and open to hearing, discussing what that might be.
Did
They
they know what
also
they were in for? In the program, they're listed as something like actor one, actor two. I think you're actor five.
Yeah, I'm actor five, technically, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, when they showed up for audition, is that what they knew? I mean, what do they know when they're going to audition for you in terms of who they're going to play? Are they, you're going to be actor three?
So, when we ran auditions, I probably gave way too much information, as I tend to do, but we gave them the roles, what each one constitutes of, and we didn't see any one actor for all generations. We picked out selects. Our audition process was a long one, and we didn't want to make it even longer because it needed a lot. Comedy, improv, song, and also relationship scenes and monologues. So we really had to like delineate maybe is the right word, essentialize what it is we needed to see from a wide variety of actors to see who we could puzzle together and make this gorgeous picture. And so what they knew was as much as I could provide them with, and I also kept an open line, like if you have any questions or if anything needs any clarification, let me know. We didn't send them the whole script, A, just because it wasn't fully developed. I mean, it was fully developed by the time we did auditions, but it was continually changing. And we also had a workshop with the cast that we had cast right before our rehearsal process started. So we had three workshops total, and then we only had our final cast on the last workshop. And so that was a bit of table work as well, and get exercising ideas and getting to know the tone of the play. And some of us, like up until maybe preview week, we didn't really understand it until we had the component of the audience. As I mentioned at Looking Glass, like the audience is the other, our final character, our final castmate. And so once you get our final castmate in, then you go, oh, okay, this is the story, especially in a comedy.
Well, typically in theater, we don't break the fourth wall, which is the audience, but here that's like part of the show is breaking that wall. I'm curious, when everybody got cast and maybe you're around the table, whatever, there had to be things that got developed bits because of, I'm thinking the actor who plays dads, the actor who's playing the moms, they're so amazing. I can't imagine you weren't struck with this would be great with you doing it.
Oh, yes, yeah. And that's what I mean. Like, we were across the board, everyone who laid hands and hearts, as my fellow ensemble mate Karim Bendiali says, on this play, everyone who laid hands and hearts on it is of a collaborative nature. And so I would pitch them on stuff. They would pitch me on stuff of like, oh, what if I did this? What if they'd go home and think about it and come back and I watch the scene again and they came up with an idea that I like was so delighted by, or that we would then yes and be like, wait, what if, and if you do this, and then what about adding that to it? And so we definitely were collaborative. And of course, there's bits where it's like, oh, when you do it in front of an audience, it like, oh, that's a very funny bit. But in the rhythm of the f entire play, it's a bit of a hitch, or it takes us out. So we got to also essentialize and edit as we continue on. So,
And I know your parents, your family were there for opening night. Again, relationships of, families that have certain specific cultures can be really complex. So I'm curious, in the Assyrian culture, do parents come out and say, "Ah, fabulous, I've never seen a show like that," or are they more like, "Ah, you could have done better," I mean, what cultural hit you took?
if they were the latter, I don't think I'd be an artist. I don't think I'd be a comedian. But no, my mom was very. I watched her. They were sitting up in the balcony, and I kind of kept eyes on them while I did some punchlines. Some punchlines I directed directly toward them because I knew that they would get it. And my mom was very proud and very effusive. She came to the very first workshop as well, and so I wanted her there to just to be like, this is the show that I'm writing. Is this cool with you? You know? And she was very proud then. And then my dad, of course, is a little harder to impress, because he will be like, that was okay. And you go, he said it was okay. Yes.
Yes, I've reached the
That's
pinnacle.
amazing. And then like everyone around me is like, ooh. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. That's really good. And so he suffers from he has Parkinson's. And so it was very hard for him to speak by the end of the night when I came out to see them. But I went like, I gave him a thumbs up or a thumbs down. What do you think? And he pulled me in and he said, I'm very proud of you. So that was everything. Yeah. I was a little worried, because I was like, oh, all the things my entire family has told me as the little middle child, eldest daughter, family historian and ear, a therapist, nurse, that I'm putting them, I've taken notes and I've put them into this thing that I'm showing publicly. Is that cool? And to get their approval like that. And
Oh,
there were
and what a
many.
blessing to have them. I think I've lost my parents, and I think of some of the things that have happened since they've been gone. You just, oh, what you wouldn't give to just know that, and maybe they know, I don't know, but what you wouldn't give to just, hear them say what your parents said to you. So
Yeah.
that is amazing. Before I let you go, I have to bring up Zero Day with Robert De Niro. Are
Listen,
you going to be doing Godfather 4 with him? Is there any chance that that's what follows?
sorry, I'm getting a phone call right now. Hello, Mr. Yeah,
Look, it's Mike Schmidt from Zero Day.
I'll be in Godfather 4. I play the cannoli. No, that would be an absolute dream to it. What it
By the way,
a.
if you play the cannoli, you get to go because the line
Yeah,
was,
I get
"I'm
to
done,"
go.
and take the cannoli. Okay.
It was a dream come true to be a share a set and be in the same room, breathing the same air as this man. Talk about like having seen everything by the time I was five. Like that was specifically one person who my dad was like, this is the greatest actor. You have to study him. So that was a dream come true. And if should more should anything beyond that dream come true, I welcome it. Yeah,
Are you
that
not look, you're an improv, you're also a comedic actress. Is there how do you not look at him and go, you talking to me? You
Oh,
talking to
absolute
me?
nerves. Having absolute nerves, trying not to make myself look absolutely foolish in front of like one of my heroes. That kept me silent. Absolute shyness.
What a career you're having, and you're still so young. It's amazing. There's so much ahead of you. That I can't wait to see what comes next. Astra Azdu, congratulations on Iraq But Funny. It may be Iraq, but it is funny. And congratulations on such a work of accomplishment, a world premiere, but it's going to, I am convinced, will be seen in other theaters around the country, and perhaps Broadway itself. We'll see. If Purpose can do it, you can do it. That's what I'm looking for. Once again, Iraq But Funny, playing at the Looking Glass Theater through July 20th. Tickets at lookingglasstheater.org. Thank you for being with me. It's such an
Thank
honor to
you so
meet you.
much, Paul. It's an honor to be speaking with you and also on your show. And thank you so much for making it to opening night and supporting us. So thank you so much. Thank
Oh,
you.
it's my pleasure. And thanks to all who are watching us here. Be sure you see Iraq But Funny, and we'll see you on the next Behind the Curtain. Thank you so much.
Bye. Curtain closed.